Welcome to Total Health Transformation Podcast, hosted by Dr. Danny Scarhill. Dr. Danny is a doctor of chiropractic, an author, speaker, and trainer. And on the THT podcast, he interviews other health experts to glean further insights that will help you achieve total health transformation.
Welcome to the Total Health Transformation Podcast. My name's Dr. Danny Scarhill, the founder of DannyScarhill.com, the author of Total Health Transformation, the proven system to unlock limitless energy, motivation, and health, and the creator of the Total Health Transformation programs. Let's get straight into it on this episode. Welcome to this episode. I've got another fantastic guest for you, Dr. Simon Billings. Simon graduated from the ACC in 2001 and works 3 days a week as a chiropractor in Southampton. He uses integrative nutritional and functional medicine as a key component for the treatment of chronic conditions. He consults with clients internationally via his internationally based nutritional practice with an interest in autoimmune conditions. He's the founder of the Academy of Chiropractic Nutrition, an online protocol-driven nutrition program for neuromechanical practitioners. Welcome to the THT podcast, Dr. Simon. How are you doing, mate?
I'm very, very good. Thank you for having me.
Excellent. Good stuff. So for those people that perhaps are hearing of you the first time, tell us a bit about your journey. How did you get to where you are today?
So I was very sporty as a young man, a lot of tennis, cricket, football, that kind of stuff. And then when I was 13, I had had a back injury and I went the standard medical route. So I had x-rays and then a bone scan and then eventually an MRI, which back then took quite a while. But I was unable to put my shoes and socks on. And so all the tennis dried up. And then in the meantime, my mum took me to see a local chiropractor in Fareham and she treated me. I got better. That was pretty amazing. And that kind of sowed a seed for me that that might be something in the future as a career. And that was, I was 13 then. So then I was able then to, I knew what I needed to get from a GCC point of view and then an A-level point of view. I struggled a bit at A-level because I had a real problem concentrating a lot through my school years. And that went up, it took me 3 years to get my A-levels. I really struggled with chemistry. Then I got to chiropractic college. And then, again, struggled a little bit in the first few years and then got through that. And during that period there in my training, 5 years of training, I got a lot of aches and pains. I was getting tendonitis here, there and everywhere, backache, headache. I'd got my skin would peel off my hands at times, I'd get dandruff, I'd have bleeding gums, I had acne appeared like when I was a young man. And had insomnia, I had IBS, had a whole load of stuff coming on. And I didn't really think anything of it. I just kind of carried on. And then I qualified. And then these aches and pains got worse and worse, as did some of the other symptoms. And then eventually, then I got diagnosed with a form of arthritis. So it's a bit like ankylosing spondylitis. So it's a bit like rheumatoid for people who are not practitioners, where it attacks the pelvis and the middle of your spine. And so when I got diagnosed with that, that was pretty, you know, as a chiropractor, I'd seen patients with this condition and I knew what could happen to them and it wasn't pretty, you know, they weren't having a great time. And I also knew what the standard medical route was. It was fairly standard, you know, anti-inflammatories. And if that didn't work, then you'd suppress the immune system and then there's sort of a layered more and more drugs. And also my brother had had a similar diagnosis previously and it led him down a path that I didn't wish to follow. So that led me on a bit of a discovery. I'd always had an interest in nutrition and things anyway, but that led me really, I had to then really, really expand my mind and work hard and experiment with diets and lab testing and stuff. And I did pretty well on that. But then a year or two after that, I got psoriasis, had my wisdom teeth extracted on one side. And then within 2 weeks, I developed psoriasis. And when I had the arthritis, as depressing as it was and upsetting, it was kind of my secret. I didn't have to tell anyone about it. My wife knew, but no one else knew really. Whereas with the psoriasis, there was no hiding that at all. That was on my hands. And so when I was, you know, I treat a lot of children and, you know, these great, you know, scaly lesions on my hands and my legs, and I didn't want to wear shorts when I went out. It was really, really depressing. I felt very, very ashamed, very toxic emotion. And that then made me push on again, even deeper. And so I had to do a whole load more gut protocols. And I actually had this tooth here, was a root canal, and I had I cycled into a car when I was 17 and smashed my face. had a root canal put in, and it was around about that time that I started to get a few symptoms. In hindsight, along with the medication I took for acne, I took 2 years of antibiotics for my skin, and obviously now we're a bit more au fait with that. We know that antibiotics do kill bad bugs, which can be life-saving, but they also kill all your good ones. We know now that your gut is the seat of your immunity. Probably 70% of your immunity lives in the gut, and your gut bacteria and you developed over millions of years in a beautiful symbiotic, mutually beneficial relationship. And if you kill them off with antibiotics for 2 years, you're going to have a problem later on. And then I took a drug called Roaccutane, which was for acne, very high dose vitamin A derivative, very toxic to the liver. And I think those things, that kind of combination there, really pushed me over the edge. And that was the beginning. In hindsight, my autoimmunity was there, like I said, in the college years, when I was 18, 19, that's why I was getting aches and pains all over the body. My body was beginning to sort of tear itself apart. I just didn't know it at the time. So I had that tooth removed, had all my wisdom teeth where they'd been removed. I had a hole in the bone. So he was able just to push a blunt instrument through a patch of, gum and into a hole in the bone. And there was infected tissue he could just scoop out. And I had all that done. I had 4 days of intravenous glutathione and vitamin C and a whole load of other stuff. Did some more gut work. And also I realized then that I had the gene for celiac disease. So I've been busy as a student, particularly a lot of gluten, probably 3 times a day. And that gluten for me, my body, my immune system perceives it to be a threat. So it only knows one way to deal with that, and that's to kill it. And that one language, and that's inflammation. And I think the inflammation from the gluten as a child, brewing, and then a couple of factors, the drugs, and then the root canal here, pushed me over the edge. And then that's when all my autoimmune issues then became much more obvious. And then I could then slowly work my way through those. I'm in remission now. And then that's how I then come to divide my time between being a chiropractor 3 days a week and then 2 days a week consulting with clients on a variety of issues, but certainly autoimmunity is one of them, along with sort of chronic fatigue stuff and fibromyalgia and so on.
You've been on quite some journey there over the past decade or two, haven't you?
It's been emotional. I think it's fair to say, and expensive. You realize when you've lost your health, getting it back is hard. And it's only, like I said, I can look back now and on my timeline, I can see I lost my health in my teens. I could see it there. And when I consult with clients one-to-one, they fill in this online form called the Living Matrix, and they ask for a date for everything. Every single thing about it, they give you, you ask for a date. And you can look back and they can say, oh, I got diagnosed with fibromyalgia here or anything here. If you look back at their teens, early adulthood to teens, maybe even early, but before, they had symptoms. They had, I had asthma and eczema, or I had a bit of an upset tummy, or I've always had terrible periods, I've had this, that. It's all there. It's just, it's the symptoms are beginning to go, the system is starting to creak, and all it needs is usually at a key life stage, for example, starting menstruation, doing your GCSEs, A-levels, maybe going to university, leaving the family home and going out on your own, first job, first baby. These are big key stages of life where a lot of stress comes in. And if you're already primed, it's just enough to push you over the edge. And people think that's the thing that did it. Like when they have migraines, they say, if I eat chocolate, I get a migraine. If I get stressed, I get a migraine. Well, lots of people eat chocolate and get stressed. They never get any migraines. So it's not that's the problem. The problem is that your foundations of your health are just completely gone. And it's enough just to push you over.
Absolutely, for sure. So over the years, by the sounds of it, you've learned an awful lot of lessons. Mm. What were some of the biggest learnings that you had about making changes in your life in terms of your health?
Yeah. So I think you're right. I've done a lot of stuff. I spent a lot of money, and some of it, I spent a lot of money on supplements, and some of it was well spent, but a lot of it probably wasn't. Either it just wasn't appropriate for me. I was chasing symptoms and I was going on hope more than anything, or good marketing following, deep down, we all kind of want a silver bullet. We want this one pill. Now, in the medical world, that's quite normal. They're using drugs because they can suppress a symptom or a system with a drug. And that it works very well, actually, in the acute emergency A&E style medicine. It works really well. So if you have a very severe headache and you've got this rash that won't go away and you can't tolerate light, we know that probably means you have meningitis, and as the flow chart kicks in and they're going to stuff you full of antibiotics and steroids and a whole lot of other stuff. And that can be life-saving because it will just squash the symptoms in the short term and allow the body to get over it. But the medication is only in the short term. You don't take those long term, those drugs. So it's not a problem. It's appropriate. The problem is when you apply the same logic to a longer term or a chronic issue like diabetes or, you know, depression, whatever we're calling depression, then they squash the symptoms with the drug. But of course, the root cause is still there. So the drug has to remain if you want the benefits, whatever they may be, then you've got it long term. So deep down, we kind of want the same thing with nutrition sometimes. It's quite easy to fall into that trap of chasing symptoms with supplements. So the best things I've found are you get the foundational stuff is the food intake. And it's really important. You can eat the best. I want in my clients, I want high nutrient density food. That has to be there because your body is just a series of pathways. It's like a conveyor belt in a factory. You start with building blocks, it gets passed down the line, and at the end you get a product, and that might be a hormone or a muscle cell or whatever it might be. It could be a neurotransmitter. And along that path, to skip along the conveyor belt, you need a vitamin or a mineral at every step to make it flow. And then you've got to break it down. And if you don't have the building blocks, which are usually a fat or a protein, if you don't have those bits in the middle, which are vitamins and minerals, your pathway can't flow. So the basics, you need good stuff to allow your body to work normally. So nutrient density is key. But also, you've got to have a high tolerance to those foods because every food comes with a benefit and risk. So if you have immune reactions, so for me, for gluten, there may be some nutritional benefits in wheat-based products, not a lot, but there's something. But my tolerance to it is none. I just genetically, I cannot, my immune system will not tolerate it. And if you're eating foods that your body does not tolerate, that will generate inflammation. From an immune response, your body perceived it to be a threat, and you will not be healthy because it's going to mean that your gut becomes leaky, and instead of being like a mesh tight weave, it becomes like a colander with big gaping holes, and you're going to hemorrhage food into the bloodstream. You're going to hemorrhage nasty bugs and toxins in. So we want high density food, but you've got to be able to tolerate it. So if you get those bits right, the good nutrients in, and you've got to remove foods that you're reacting to, and gluten, it's very. When I started 10, 15 years ago doing this stuff, being gluten-free without a diagnosis of celiac disease was a bit odd and people didn't really understand it. And I could walk into a pub to have a meal and say, like, you know, I can't eat gluten. And they'd ask me, was I a celeriac? And so it really was weird. And, you know, getting gluten-free food was a problem in terms of, like, you know, just beyond eating vegetables and meats and so on. Now it's very mainstream. All seems a bit obvious, but 50% of our population have the gene for celiac disease, if you're Caucasian, that is. So that doesn't mean you're going to get celiac disease per se, but it means that you have a genetic tendency to react to gluten. And that is profoundly important because if you're eating gluten and your body perceives it to be a threat, it will instigate inflammation. And inflammation is the rate at which you age effectively. They call it inflammaging. So it's going to rip your body apart and it will give you a variety of symptoms all over the body. It might be skin stuff. It might be that you get tired. It might be a cognitive decline. It could be dizziness. It could be balance problems, a million and one things, as well as gut problems. But it's so foundational. So I always, for my clients, I do a little reset at the beginning. I say, just cut gluten and dairy out. And if they can do it, eggs and nuts and a few other things, just for 2 weeks. I keep it nice and short and sweet. Because if it's something in there that's enough of a problem, they pull it out, they'll generally get an improvement in energy, pain, mood will improve. They'll get something that will change. And then they can reintroduce the foods one at a time and just play with it a little bit and see how they feel. So I go for removal of the foods that might have a tolerance issue and try and put them in real food with high nutrient density to get the building blocks and the good stuff going. And then the other one I do first also that really is a big bang for buck is sleep. It seems so obvious and it's everyone knows they should get 8 hours and very few people do. And particularly the hours before 12 o'clock are sort of golden. They're almost worth double. So if you slept from 10 until 6, that's 8 hours, you're going to feel great. If you slept from 12 till 8, you don't nearly feel as good in the morning. And that probably tunes into our evolutionary ancestry with the natural rhythm of dark and light and going to bed when it gets dark and so on. So I go for the foundation, which is food, nutrients high, but with food that you must tolerate. And then I go for the sleep. And with the sleep stuff, one of the key things is just getting rid of them, taking the mobile phone and turning it off and putting it in a drawer that you won't see it for the evening. and potentially even some clients need to wear the like an orange glass, like an orange lens, and that will cut out the blue part of light, which tells your brain it's blue light tells your brain it's daytime, and screens like iPads and TVs and so on have a lot of blue light, and the orange lens cuts out the blue light and it tells your brain it's nighttime, and then you start to produce melatonin, and you can then, when you want to go to sleep, you can drift off. And if you get a good night's sleep, we all know that you feel better. And if you have a bad night's sleep regularly, you just get tired and life seems harder and you make bad food choices in the day and you get a bit of a vicious cycle going.
Like you say, it's not rocket science, is it? Everybody knows we need to have a good 7-8 hours kip, yeah. But most people don't do it. And when you do, it makes a huge difference, doesn't it?
It's massive. Yeah, it's massive. That's one of the reasons I do that first. It's so important, we know. But also the compliance for that with clients is exceptionally high, because when I say how much sleep you get, they all fess up immediately and say, I should get more. I know I should. I should be bed earlier. I know I should. So they kind of know that. And that makes it a lot easier as a sell. And if they feel better and they have more energy, then the ability then to make genuine lifestyle changes is much better. If you're knackered all the time, trying to remove foods and, you know, do better, you know, going out and buying better food is much, much harder work. So it's an easy sell with profound benefits. And we know that across the board, you get less pain, you get more energy. There's a link with heart disease and cancers, and like almost everything goes wrong if you can't get your sleep. So it's a fairly easy thing to do.
Oh, for sure. It's an easy, quick win, isn't it? Cool. Yeah. So in terms of, I can obviously see and hear the passion in your voice. You obviously love what you do. What's your big driver for doing the work that you do today?
When I was diagnosed with psoriasis, so I was a bit suspicious of what it might be. Initially it didn't look like, kind of comes up as little pustules and then it starts to grow and then becomes more of it. And when she diagnosed it as psoriasis, I was gutted. And she said to me then, well, psoriasis, so you're gonna have some steroid cream. If that doesn't work, we'll give you coal tar to smear on you. If that doesn't work, we can give you, you know, immune blockers. And then, you know, another beyond that is biological. They just shut your immune system down. And I luckily had a, because of the history with the AS, I had a book in my office called Integrative Rheumatology. And it was written by a chiropractor who was also a naturopath and a doctor of osteopathic medicine from the States called Alex Vasquez. And in there, he had a section on psoriasis, and he was quoting some research from a group in Tennessee. And they had found that actually the vast majority of psoriasis was related to fungal infections and bacterial infections. And in fact, this had been known for probably 50 years before that people who get recurrent tonsillitis often will get psoriasis afterwards. And if you remove their tonsils, their psoriasis will often disappear because it's a seeding point for lots of bacteria to hang out, and they can't ever quite clear it. So when she told me all this, I was furious. I was so angry because I felt like she'd taken away my hope. And if, you know, dictators and lots of people know that if you take away someone's hope, they give up. They just give up. And she didn't mean to. She was just doing what she was trained to do. And, you know, very, very, doctors are very, very smart people, but they're trained for so long in this blinkered way. They have their model and their float, and there's nothing beyond that they can look, but they lose all kind of flexibility in their thinking, I think. So I was just taking away my hope, and I knew that wasn't true, and I was able to go and do something about it. But then I see that with clients when they have symptoms, and they might come to see me, and they go to see the doctor, and I know they're going to give them a name. And I know that people want to know what they have. They want a name. They absolutely want it. They want to say they've got fibromyalgia or IBS or whatever it is. But the problem then is it can then become a point where the label then kicks in a float up with it. And that means you've got this thing. You've got, I don't know, whatever it is, psoriasis, right? And that's it. It's a skin condition. It's incurable. And what else? And they take away their hope. And they don't mean to, but they do it. And that's the bit that upsets me, because I've recovered. And I have clients that recover. And I know that's possible. And I also see when it does wrong. And, you know, personally, from my brother's point of view, it hasn't worked well for him. He's had the same things that I've had. He's taken the other route. And he's not a well man. And you know, has mental health issues and recovering alcoholic and a whole lot of other stuff. So I see it firsthand in my brother, and it's very upsetting, because I know that that is avoidable potentially with the right work and the right support. Not easy. It's not an easy route for sure for your, you know, for your, all your the people watching. It is not an easy route at the beginning. You will have to make sacrifices, There's no doubt about it, financially, emotionally, energy, all these things, it comes at a cost. But, you know, if you don't take that initial step and make the sacrifice, you will sacrifice your health in the longer term. Taking that pill in the short term to suppress the symptoms is easy, feels better, but there is no free ride. If you just take the drugs, it's still going to carry on, and you're going to get side effects, and it carries on and on. And they'll always give you another name for the drug, for the side effect, and the other problem that you get, and they'll always have another drug for it. But it doesn't mean that you're going to be able to live a life that you want to lead. And so then that's the question I often ask my clients. You know, you have to choose your sacrifice. You know, what are you willing to give up and sacrifice to achieve what you want? At the moment, you're sacrificing your health to be able to eat these foods that you like, whatever it is, junk food and, you know, toast and whatever it is. You know, are you willing to sacrifice these to get your health? That's all it is choosing your sacrifice. You don't get to choose if you make a sacrifice. You have to choose what you're going to sacrifice, and then live with the consequences. Because once your body's damaged, it can be, you know, something that's not always repairable. Like my pelvis, for example, is partly fused, and my middle thoracic spine is partly fused because I went undiagnosed at college for, well, I had from 5 years of university, and then at least how long now? 5, maybe 10 years as a chiropractor being treated, and everyone had missed it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Even with x-ray as well.
Yeah. So, unfortunately, x-rays are, you know, they're a relatively blunt instrument because they're looking for the joint in the SI joint, the sacral, the pelvic joints. Most people won't show any damage on x-ray for 10 years. So I've seen plenty of people who've got, you know, like you would know, like a classic diagnosis for ankylosing spondylitis is they have excruciating buttock pain that wakes them up at night, or mid back pain that wakes them up at night. If you have that, like, it's there. There is something that's not normal. You shouldn't wake up at night with excruciating and alternating bum pain. It's just not right. And I've seen plenty of people with x-rays completely normal, and I push them off the GP and, you know, ask them to do MRIs, and they don't want to hear it half the time. So yeah, an MRI would pick it up if they were actively inflamed. And that's sometimes quite an issue because in autoimmunity, we get flares where you'll flare up and then down, then up and then down. And if you catch them on the up and you get a raised inflammatory marker in the blood, that will raise suspicion amongst anyone. But the problem is then often, if you don't have anything else obvious on x-ray, they'll say, well, let's test again in a few weeks. And often they'll drop down. And that's why the average time from symptom onset to diagnosis with ankylosing spondylitis is about 10 years. And that can be a real problem. The flares, by the way, that is because usually that you have a infection somewhere in the gut, maybe in the sinuses. They have a life cycle. When they die, they in their cellular wall, they have a very powerful toxin and gets released into the bloodstream, and it triggers inflammation throughout the body. And when you get enough of those dying off in one go, you get this big flare of inflammation that peaks and then troughs down again. And that's often why they're getting flares. So you see that MS as well, people get flares.
That's fascinating, that. Mm. Absolutely fascinating. So another thing that's has been very, very prevalent in the Western world for a long time and just gets more and more prevalent is the big C, isn't it? Mm. Cancer.
Mm.
What are your viewpoints on the causes of cancer and the traditional medical model treatment of that, if you like?
So again, we're in the public and the medical world. They want one thing. You know, they're looking for this one thing that causes cancer, or this one gene that causes cancer. And that's not reality. And we have to look at our evolutionary ancestry. So we used to die primarily of infections. You know, sort of 25, 50% of people died before they reached adulthood of infections. Now we have antibiotics to stop that. So we're now living longer. And what we really need to do is, we know that it's prevention is the way we're going to get at cancer, because once you've got cancer, you're going to have it removed almost certainly. You're going to need to cut it out, and then you're going to have some kind, potentially depending on how far it's grown, some kind of radiotherapy which is going to burn you, or some kind of poison which is chemo. And you know, by that point, there's always going to be consequences of those treatments potentially, and there's always going to be potential for, you know, within 5 years, 10 years to be a relapse. So we know there's some people have genetic tendencies for poor detoxification, for example, or are very inflammatory. And then you apply your environmental factors, and that'll be your diet, your exercise, how much stress you're under. And things like pollution is a massive thing. We saw that the World Health Organization, I can't remember the numbers, but they said something like, I think like 2 million people a year die from, you know, preventable respiratory issues because of pollution. And we now see with the recent lockdown, pollution has suddenly just dropped like a stone and things are changing. So, you know, we kind of take it for granted that the roads are busy and we don't really necessarily appreciate all these things you can't see in the air that you're breathing in and causing cancer. So we know that it's environmental, it's lifestyle primarily, and that the actual percentage chance of getting cancer is higher now than it's ever been, ever. And that's where it's a little bit disingenuous with some of the cancer charities. They're very keen to talk about your chance of survival after you've had cancer. After you've been diagnosed, how likely are you to survive? How much they've improved that? And they have improved it, not a massive amount in most cancers, with the exception of some childhood leukemias, who've done a very good job. Most of them, they haven't made huge inroads in actual percentage of people surviving. What they're better at is earlier diagnosis. That's the big thing, because it hasn't spread as far. But the best thing you're ever going to do, of course, is not get cancer. So that's where they are trying to do a little bit of this, but they are still very orientated on early diagnosis. And if I was being skeptical, I would say maybe that's also because some of the funding comes from drug companies and that they are interested in the early diagnosis and treatment because they can make money on that of cancer. But the prevention, so never getting cancer. So if you have a history of breast cancer in your family, being very careful with your liver health, for example, is extremely important because your body makes estrogen and then you've got to break it down into different things and remove it. And if you're poor at that, you make very still quite active estrogen products that are very pro-cancerous. And we know this because if you get breast cancer, if it's sensitive to estrogen, which they often are, they'll give you an estrogen blocker called tamoxifen. So it selectively blocks the ability of estrogen to dock onto its receptor and kind of do its thing. So we know all this. So if you wanted to be proactive, there's a couple of cancer charities run by members of the public, and their focus is purely on prevention. They talk about not using deodorant with aluminium in and getting away from plastics, which are estrogenic, and a whole lot of really cool stuff. You don't see any of that on the big cancer charities because they are dominated by professors of oncology, and they are blinkered, and a lot of their funding, you know, comes from the pharmaceutical industry, so they're focused on treatment and not prevention. So for me, again, it all comes down to basics again. Evolutionarily, you wouldn't have eaten half the stuff we do now. You wouldn't have lived like we do. So as best you can. That's why I'm a big fan of fasting. I think I don't eat breakfast generally. I have I do what's called 16-8 fasting. So you have 24 hours in a day, and I have an 8-hour feeding window where I have the same calories, the same nutrients that I'd ever have. But I start about lunchtime-ish, and I'll have 2 or 3 meals, and I'll finish about 7 or 8 o'clock. And then I get up and I don't eat breakfast, and it keeps me lean very naturally. It allows your gut to clean itself. It's very, very therapeutic. And it would mimic, again, probably as a hunter-gatherer, you wouldn't have had 3 meals a day plus snacks. That's not likely. Equally, and this is where there's very popular vegan and plant-based stuff at the moment. You see, there's a lot of tribalism in the world in general. You see that at the moment, but also in diets. There's vegan is very popular, or plant-based. And then there's also one called the carnivore diet, which is just meat, completely just meat. And again, I just think back to our hunter-gatherer days, we would have eaten what we could get our hands on. And if you caught an animal, you would have eaten it. No doubt about it, you would have eaten it. And you would have eaten their organs, not the meat first, the muscle. You would have gone straight for the liver and the kidneys and the heart and the brains. All that stuff. You would not have gone for the muscle meat. We know that from tribes. They prize organ meat above all else. And they know that because it is an incredibly dense source of nutrition. It's the most, like liver is the most densely packed nutrient on the planet. You can't beat it. There's nothing like it in the plant world because the cows and how they eat plants, and then they actually turn a lot of the vitamins and minerals on. So vitamin A from a plant is called beta carotene. It isn't terrible. There's some stuff, but it isn't the main thing. It has to be converted into the active vitamin A called retinol, That's what allows your immune system to work. It helps your skin, it helps your eyes. It's critical for everything. Without it, you're going to get ill. Now, genetically, it's very common. I have a defect in the enzyme that turns beta-carotene into retinol. I have a double defect. So my mum gave me one copy, my dad gave me one copy. That means my pathway runs potentially as low as 40% in conversion. So if I was a full-time, full-on vegan and I didn't eat any animals, I might slowly become low in vitamin A. Now that wouldn't, I wouldn't know that. I might just slowly get some skin issues, or I might get recurrent infections. I wouldn't turn up at the GP and they go, oh, it's because you're low in vitamin A, it's because you're a vegan. It's a very subtle thing. So that's what animals do. They concentrate their nutrients, they turn them on and they concentrate them in their organs. And that's the benefit of being animals. There's a whole ethical consideration I appreciate. But from my point of view, again, I know what I want for my diet, for me and my patients. I want high nutrient density. And there's nothing, the animals have that. That's what they're good for. But I would, the most important thing for people watching is you need to get quality. You shouldn't be eating red meat every day, I don't believe. And what you should be doing is going to farms that are grass, are organic, don't use antibiotics, and grass-fed animals, and eating, you know, red meat once, twice a week, maybe an offal once, twice a week, and yeah, eat less meat, but eat really good quality. So you're not stuffing yourself full of antibiotics and hormones and things that are in the meat. And then basing your plate around plants and a variety of plant matter, because we also know that, you know, it's not, you're not eating just for you. You're eating for 100 trillion friends who live in your colon, 100 trillion bacteria, and they make B vitamins for you. They make, they are part of your immune system. So we've got to keep them happy as well. So that's what I tend to do, that kind of plant-based stuff, along with a bit of offal and some good quality meat, and try and keep it as close as I can, but I think my hunter-gatherer might have eaten.
Yes, good stuff, mate. I agree with an awful lot of what you were just saying. You know, it makes a lot of sense to live the way our ancestors did, because, you know, we know that the human gene has barely changed at all in 30, 40,000 years, but our environment has changed dramatically, hasn't it?
Yeah, massively, massively. And particularly also with things like, I think the one of the biggest issues I have is phones. Just, they're not, they're for our little caveman brain, hunter-gatherer brain, they're just too stimulating. I had a guy yesterday who's he came in with a lot of very weird symptoms, and he basically is on his phone all evening, and he is wired, absolutely wired, and I would say addicted probably. I think that's a really insidious, dangerous thing for all of us, and particularly children. It makes me very nervous seeing young children on tablets and phones. They're having a lot of dopamine being produced, their pleasure hormone, pleasure neurotransmitter up here. Makes me nervous for future issues with inside of addiction. How are you going to get enough dopamine, your pleasure molecule, when your brain has evolved to expect a high amount of it flooding the system? What happens when you're an adult and you can't get it? I don't know.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept that, like, because everyone's on the phone all the time. It's the modern addiction, and I think I would say probably 70-80% of people are heavily addicted to their phones.
I would think that's probably fair. I think it's scary. It's scary. Also, on the topic of cancer, there's one book I could recommend that really, it's called The Secret History of the War on Cancer, by Devra Davis, and she's an epidemiologist, and it's a brilliant book. It reads a bit like a novel, but it's her story and the story of cancer, and of cancer being discovered and treated, and then the cancer societies and how they were funded by the tobacco industry heavily and affected by them and early on, and the chemical industry has a whole lot of stuff in the 50s and 60s, and all the dodgy shenanigans that went on, and all the increase in cancer we talked about, how that could be tied to various chemicals and stuff. It's a really good book to read. It's very easy to read. She makes it very readable, given some of it's quite heavy, a heavy topic, but it gives people understanding, again, it's not just bad luck. It's not just one in three people just get cancer just because, you know, you're unlucky, you're old. There is a reason we're getting more cancer. And yeah, absolutely, we want to do everything we can to avoid those chemicals as best we can, and just understand that, you know, we have a degree of control over our environment. So in our home, what we put in our mouth, what we do.
100%. So that cancer industry is one of the biggest industries on the planet. It is absolutely all about money, which you've alluded to pretty much all the way through this talk, haven't you? Cool. So in terms of how people can get in touch with you and programs and stuff that you offer, mate. Where's the best place for people to get in touch with you? And you run some nutritional programs as well, don't you?
So the best place to get hold of me is integrativecare.co.uk. So that's integrative, integrativecare.co.uk. That you can go there. It's a fairly simple website. It's just a way people can get hold of me. There's a short screening questionnaire on the front page just to make sure that, because I don't have lots of free clinical time, I need to make sure that people that want to work with me are willing to actually do the work needed, so we don't end up not being a good fit. And then any practitioners, there's you can go to Academy of Chiropractic Nutrition. It's Academy of Chiropractic Nutrition purely because I am a chiropractor, but we have osteopaths and physios on there. So that is specifically nutritional training for practitioners who deal with the neuromechanical system and the way in which when people turn up with certain symptoms, how does the nutritional metabolic world overlap to make them, why do some people recover with care from one particular practitioner and other people with the same set of symptoms turn up and just don't respond? And often the answers can lay in the metabolic system, how their chemistry is and the food they take and the deficiencies they have.
Excellent. Well, thanks for taking out the time to be with us on the THT podcast today, Dr. Simon. It's very much appreciated.
Absolute pleasure.
You've been listening to the THT podcast with myself, Dr. Danny Scarhill. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Podbean, or any one of the other outlets where we stream. Like us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/totalhealthtransformation. You can also find more information about myself on my website, dannyscarhill.com. where you'll find lots of fantastic information and some free products for you as well. Look forward to seeing you on the next episode. Take care. All the best.
You've been listening to Dr. Danny Scarhill on the Total Health Transformation Podcast, helping you to eat, move, and think on purpose. See you on our next episode.